Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode. I'm Cody. I'm in a post Thanksgiving days. I don't know. We didn't have basketball for a whole day. Do you remember the teams that are still in the NBA?
It was actually a really strange experience because, you know, I was at my wife's family's place and they were watching some football and stuff. In my head, I'm like, oh, I bet you there's an NBA game on. I could probably like sneak off to the corner and watch that. I was mistaken, Ben. I was very sorely mistaken about that.
Yeah, it's a tough one. On one hand, you have the day off and there's Thanksgiving food. On the other hand, no basketball and some of us have the real withdrawals. You know, we have to find a way to offset that. So that's what we're doing today. We said we're gonna get together and record us talking about basketball. And yeah, Cody, this is a fascinating season. We alluded to some possible parity that we might see in the NBA this year. And I think early on, we're seeing the signs of that. And especially with a lot of records being so similar. That's what jumps out to me, right? It's, and we'll talk about a few teams in a second, but it's this idea of like the Clippers are 11-8 and the Mavericks are 9-8. And on one hand, those are very similar records. They both have 8 losses. On another hand, perusing the standings, you might go, oh, the Clippers are like in 4th and the Mavs are in 9th. And one of these teams is doing great and one of these teams is doing poorly. And I would agree that one of those teams looks good and the other team looks like they're really struggling and doing poorly. Only it's not what the standings look like.
So you're saying, because, you know, I'm looking at the Western Conference, especially right now, and seeds 1 through 10 all have between 6 and 8 losses. Seeds 1 through 10 have between 6 and 8 losses, but you don't quite believe that? You don't think the standings are telling the full story right now?
No, I think the cool part of what's happening right now is we have enough of a sample size to start understanding and talking about teams and figuring out who's good, you know, separating the wheat from the chaff, all that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, because there's a little more parity, because we haven't played 40 games, we've played 20, you see the standings are not going to give you the proper signal necessarily. So you look at the standings and you say, the Clippers, 11-8, up near the top of the conference, I believe. The Mavs, the Mavs aren't even in a playoff position. Are they in a play-in game right now, like 9-8? I'm not sure, but they're far apart in the standings. And I actually think all the indicators suggest that the Mavs are playing really well, similar to where they were last season at the end of the year when they made their run to the conference finals. We've talked about Luka last time. We've had the video on the Thinking Basketball YouTube channel and how they're using him in the post. And if you look at their margin of victory, you look at their sort of shooting luck, opponent shooting luck, things early in the season that can throw some games or whatever. You look at their strength of schedule, the fact that their offense looks pretty good, which you expect, and their defense looks pretty good, which is how they did it last season. They look to me like a strong playoff team. The Clippers, on the other hand, the Clippers have had the best opponent three-point shooting luck in the league. Their offense looks broken. They have health problems, and they've played a really easy schedule. So the board we look at for Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball, has sort of an updated win pace that looks at these numbers. And even though the Clippers are 11-8 and the Mavs are 9-8, they're on opposite ends of the board. The Mavs are up near the top of the league and the Clippers are down near the bottom.
Yeah, I'm looking at this right now, and the Mavericks, according to your database, expected 52 win pace at the moment, whereas the Clippers are down to a 32 win pace. So even though the Clippers are higher in the seeding, like it's a 20
win
pace. Win
gap.
That's not like a plus 0.1 difference or something like that. Like this is a substantial difference in the way that these two teams are performing.
Right. So that's kind of the incredible part of this season with some of the parity is you have how many teams in the league right now sitting on you know, 7, 8, 9 losses. Some of them with 6, some of them with 10. And so their records look really similar. Another team that we didn't talk about a couple episodes ago, and we were talking about teams that are looking more legit or less legit, the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls are 8-10, but they've played well defensively. They've hung around on offense. Maybe they can get healthier. But again, you know, if you just look at the raw standings, you might think Denver and Nikola Jokic up near the top of the Western Conference, they're doing their thing. And the Bulls are also doing their thing of late, which is disappointing and struggling. And it's like, actually, the Bulls, when you look at margin of victory, when you look at strength of schedule, when you look at these other factors, they've played pretty well through 18 games, all things considered. The Nuggets, and I think this jumps out on film, they've been bumpy. You know, Jamal Murray's not close to being back to Jamal Murray. Michael Porter Jr. is still getting his feet and his movement patterns under him. And so credit to them for eking out wins. I think as long as Jokic is there, they're going to be able to eke out wins in close games. But they're not playing with the strength you'd expect after almost 20 games from a like solid playoff team.
How much do you think that having repeat opponents is contributing to this? Because that's something that we're seeing a lot more this season, I feel like, more than past seasons, is you play the same opponent like twice in 3 nights or 3 times in a week or something like that. Do you think that that's kind of messing with these standings a little bit more?
I think that could be a small component of it, because your schedule isn't quite as diverse, and then it's a little different early in the season when you're working on stuff and you're getting up to speed, and then you can see the same team a second time in a week. Or to your point, like we talked about the Bucks and the Hawks, I mean I think they've played a 7-game series again at this point, only a month into the season or so. But that would only be a small component, because otherwise you still play different teams every night. You still have a relatively balanced home and away schedule at this point. So it's like, we know who's really good in the league right now, and we have an idea of who's, let's say, really bad or entering the NBA draft sweepstakes. But all these teams in the middle class, is really hard to sort out. It's really swollen. And it's really interesting to me to look at teams in this group, in this band of quality, and say, who kind of jumps out as a team no one's talking about as being very good? I mean, we've done a lot of work on Cleveland. Cleveland just continues to look strong. They're 12-6 in raw wins and losses. We know teams like Phoenix and Boston are going to carry over from last year. We just mentioned the Mavs. We know the Bucks are a really good team. The Pelicans continue to look strong offensively and basically across the board. I think the Pelicans have a nice squad right now, and things are trending in the right direction for them. Who knows what's going on with a team like the Brooklyn Nets? But there's one other team, Cody. There's a team that I'm in love with them. They're the new Cavs.
That's really high praise, Ben. Oh, my goodness. I didn't quite expect that.
Well, they're not as good as the Cavs.
Yeah.
But they're the new Cavs in that they're really fun, flowing, beautiful team to watch. And for a lot of people, kind of out of nowhere, because you might not know that basketball is still played in this part of the world. It's a team that hasn't had... they haven't had a lot of success in the last decade or two or three or four as a franchise, although they did have a brief glory year run. You know who I'm talking about, Cody?
Sacramento Kings. Who I don't think has played a playoff series against any current NBA player, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, they haven't made the playoffs in, 16 or 17 seasons?
Yeah.
Yeah, since the Ron Artest days. It's really weird to say. The Kings haven't made the playoffs since the Ron Artest days, and he was there for like a year or two or whatever it was. It feels like a cup of coffee. But yes, in all seriousness, not getting, because we could really get sidetracked on this podcast. I can feel it. The Kings are solid. They're good. No one's talking about them. When we look at our board, they're one of the best teams in the league in terms of looking at win pace based on these other factors. And there's a really easy place to go with them: the offense. The offense right now, just by raw numbers, is the second best offense in the league. I don't know if they can hold like a top two or top three offense, because that's going to juice your record quite a bit. But Cody, I've been watching them. I can't stop watching them. They're really, really cool watch. Their offense is good.
I think, you know, there's always the caveat of injuries, because I hate making big proclamations and they'd be completely, like, sidelined by somebody getting injured. But if they, like, especially Fox and Sabonis, stay healthy, I actually don't see why they wouldn't have a top three offense in the league. Because everything that I'm seeing, I think, you know, they're knocking down a bunch of threes and whatever else at a pretty high clip. But I don't see anything that's that they can't replicate throughout a season. Like, the way that they're playing right now, like, it totally makes sense the way that they spread out the floor. And I'm like, wow, I think this offense is actually really sustainable. You know, they don't necessarily have, like, traditional big men. And I think they just sold all out and being like, hey, you know what? Let's just open up the floor. Let's use all of our shooters. Let's use our passing hub. Let's use De'Aaron Fox's blinding speed. And let's see what happens. And right now, Ben, it's happening. And I'm, you know, I think at the end of the season, they might be a top three offense still.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's sidebar. Let's thought experiment this for a second. How many teams in the league do you think, as of today, what day is today? November 25th?
Yes, November 25th.
How many teams do you think could end the season with a top three offense? Keeping in mind, for everyone listening at home, Boston has the best offense in the league right now after a month and change. They're 7 points better than league average. Sacramento has the second best offense in the league. They're 5 points better than league average. Cleveland and Phoenix are right behind them at 4 points ahead of the league. And then you get to the Pelicans and the Utah Jazz at about 3.5 to 4 points as well. How many teams, when you glance at the standings, do you think have a legit shot at finishing top three?
Man, Ben, I'm staring at Denver. I'm just staring at Denver's logo right now. And I'm like, are they with a relative offensive rating that's plus 2.6? Do they have enough juice to climb that back up? Is there going to be drop off? Is Boston going to drop off a little bit when Rob Williams comes back? Like, is that going to affect their offense for a little bit of sacrifice for defense? Cleveland, if they stay healthy. Okay, I say Cleveland, I think they're like my for sure will be in the top three. Cleveland, I
top three for sure.
Yeah, Cleveland, lock them. If Garland and Mitchell are healthy throughout the season, they're my top three lock for sure. Phoenix is doing this without Chris Paul and Cam Johnson. That's incredible. I could see Phoenix being in there. They're probably my number two here.
What did you eat yesterday? This is spectacularly hot take. Just right out of the gate, Cleveland, lock them. I say Cleveland's like a lock for like top seven.
Top seven?
So, yeah.
What don't you... Yeah. This makes it sound like you're being super negative, but why don't you think they're going to be higher than that?
Oh, no, I'm not super negative at all. I think they could be top three. You said a lock for top three.
Yeah, lock.
Yeah. So I would have Cleveland, Phoenix, the Pelicans. I don't think Utah can finish with a top three offense.
Nope, I don't think so.
I think they'll regress a little bit. Who knows what's going to happen with the rest of their season, how many games they're going to try to win. They're a fun, you know, solid little team, as we've mentioned before. Denver's a team with potential. I don't think Indiana could get top three. I like what they're doing. We mentioned that before. I'm not sure they could get top three. Dallas?
No.
Dallas feels like a team that could get close. I might put them as a candidate. And then I think the only other team for me is Golden State, who's currently like 12th or something.
I don't necessarily see Golden State making that kind of a run. And for the Mavericks, like when they get Kleba back in the lineup and playing a little bit more, I think that's going to kind of bend them towards defense a little bit more. So yeah, I think the end of the season is probably going to be like Cleveland, Phoenix, and maybe even Sacramento. No offense to Boston, but I really think that their offense is going to switch a little bit defensively for when Rob Will comes back.
Wait a second. This is really interesting.
Okay.
You don't think Golden State right now is plus one?
Yep.
After 19 games. Who knows what's going on with Jordan Poole? Klay Thompson has been... he's been shaky, let's put it that way.
Yes.
I don't want to get up here after a nice holiday meal and say bad things about Klay Thompson, but he has not been at the best form to start the year. You don't think this team can, you know, jump most of these teams? Or if they, let's put it this way, if Golden State actually continues to win games and turn things around as they have started to a little bit here. They're up to 9-10 in the win-loss column. You don't think that can be pushed by a good offense the way Steph Curry is playing?
I mean, when you look at their... This might go into another conversation a little bit later, but when you look at their starters and when they're playing, they're posting like a 135 offensive rating in like, I don't know, what is it, like 200 some minutes? So maybe, but are the Warriors going to like lean into we're going to be playing our best guys throughout the regular season? I don't necessarily think that. And, you know, not to be a downer, but is Curry going to play the entire season? Like, are we sure he's not going to play like 65 games or something like that? And those 20 games, you know, we've seen a history of the Warriors just tanking offensively. So I think too many things need to go their way to get up into the top three offenses.
Interesting. Interesting. So does this mean, in a way, you're saying the like for you to have the Warriors in the top four in the West, they would need to really turn it around defensively then?
Yeah, I think so.
But do you think that's going to happen? This sounds like you're selling the Warriors.
No, for the regular season. We're talking regular season right now. I think they're a team that's, they seem to be playing like they're in a bit of a, you know, we're taking it slow right now. We can maybe turn it on when we get to the playoffs. And I still believe in them when they get to that point. But over an 82-game season, I don't necessarily think that.
Okay. So I would have Golden State. I think it's possible for them to get top three. Maybe Dallas, Denver, the Pelicans, Phoenix, Cleveland, Sacramento, Boston. So I think Sacramento is probably going to finish with one of the better offenses in the league. And that's where we were going before we had that fun little sidebar. Spicy little sidebar already. Here's the thing. This offense of the Kings is legitimately good. They have talent. The talent fits together, and they're playing a great style. Credit to Mike Brown and that coaching staff there. Mike Brown, of course, at Golden State, longtime assistant there and old head coach in the league. Multiple stops for many years, including LeBron James back in Cleveland when they went to the finals in 2007. But Kevin Huerter, I mean, how much time do we have to talk about Kevin Huerter? Red Velvet. How good has this guy been?
I mean, he's unbelievable. I haven't looked at the numbers, but for a period of time, what, he was shooting over 50% from three? And like a not particularly easy attempts all the time either. Like, he gets wide open looks because of the nature of their offense, but, you know, his shooting clip was literally on a historical run there.
So you're saying you have a problem with Kevin Huerter taking 7.5 threes a game and shooting 49.6%.
Oh, that's below 50. What a scrub.
He dipped below 50, yeah.
That's unbelievable. Yeah.
The interesting thing is he takes 11 threes per 100, which is still not in the mega, you know, gunning Steph Curry, just these other guys that let it fly. I think he should probably find a way to shoot a few more threes if possible. It reminds me a little bit of Kyle Korver. Wow, I'm getting my KKs mixed up here. What, this is a post-meal malaise, I meant. Okay, Kyle Korver with the Hawks. I'm just going to be Marv Albert by next year, just like saying random names when I mention basketball players. we've lost Cody. 2015 Hawks, where Kyle Korver was an intricate part of that offense with his movement and off-ball activity and coming off screens and all that. But he's a guy that averages at the end of the day, like, what, 15 points a game or something that doesn't look that impressive. Movement shooters and shooters of this level have shown over and over and over again in plus-minus studies that they are extremely valuable to offenses in a way that exceeds their points per game and their assist numbers. And that's the thing about Huerter. Huerter's got a few passing chops too. So he's running around and they're incorporating these sets that allow him to move, come off screens in the corner, you know, fly off two picks and play a little two-man game with Sabonis then at the top of the key or something like that, hand off into a three. And so 50%, the way he's shooting, the way he's passing, the way he's moving, he's like been legitimately awesome on offense to watch for this team.
See, I agree with you, but I think if we're going to have any conversation about the Kings, I think everything has to start with Sabonis in the way that they run their offense. And I think Herter is able to get his openings and is able to use his off-ball movement because of the way that they're using Sabonis. Because when you look at some of the lineups, like let's say, you know, they have Fox, Barnes, Herter, Sabonis, Davis out there, Murray, whatever else. Sabonis is the guy that's not going to be able to shoot, but when you bring him up to the top and you run like a delay set where you have him being the dribble handoff hub while everyone else kind of flows around, what's really tricky about the way that they run their offense is, you know, there's a common set that they run where, you know, you have Herter over in the corner, you have Sabonis up top doing a dribble handoff. He does his little handoff action, and then Herter comes over from the corner and sets a back screen for Sabonis, who like dives into the paint. And a lot of teams kind of have this natural inclination to switch everything. You know, you see it with the Grizzlies did a couple times. The Warriors was switching everything against it. But you can't do that against Sabonis because he's such a physical, strong post-up guy, right? He's not necessarily like the best post scorer in the league, but he's the kind of guy that if he gets a small on him, he is absolutely going to bang them into the basket, throw it down, put up a nice little hook. So then all of a sudden you have to kind of scramble around to get maybe a double team or try and scram switch it. And in that instant, right, I don't think Sabonis is like the greatest passer ever, but he has like really nice post feel. And from that, it just begins this cascading effect of like finding the open guy immediately. They know how to cut so well. They know how to kind of set up in a different space. And in that, there's like this wild chaos. And that's where Kevin Herter and everyone else in the offense, especially De'Aaron Fox, finding openings for driving. I think that's where they really thrive. And it all begins with Sabonis being able to have like that DHO ability and just like strong post mobility against smaller guys.
Yeah, the Sabonis hub of the offense is definitely one huge thing that's going on here, where they're using him as a big man that can combine handoff action in the middle of the floor up at the top of the key. That's the delay set Cody was alluding to there, where usually you're like five out and you get it to the big man at the top, and then he can turn, you can do handoff stuff, you can hit little backdoor quick cutters, they'll throw in split cuts with him at the elbow. And so basically his decision making and his ability to pass in those spots opens up this style of offense and this sort of playbook that runs around him. When he's off the floor, they almost have a slightly different looking offense because they can't run stuff through him. They can't punish switches and get him sealing smaller defenders under the basket. So it's a little bit different. You might get more De'Aaron Fox, but you might also see some more movement stuff that doesn't necessarily involve running everything through a big man in the middle of the floor. But I just think the totality of the way Fox is playing, both pick and roll, early offense, speed attack, what you mentioned about Sabonis and Herter's movement, if you look at the numbers, they're the best when Herter's on the floor. 123.4 offensive rating. Sabonis is just under 123. Fox is back at 122. So that's the meat of their team successfully on offense. Those are their three best offensive players by my eye and by a pretty clear jump statistically. They look like the three best offensive players for the Kings. And to put this in perspective, when Kevin Herter's out there with that 123 offensive rating, Cody, that's the sixth highest on-court offensive rating for any player in the league, regardless of you know, whether they're like playing 17 minutes a game for the Celtics. Sam Hauser actually has the highest in that stat because he comes off the bench. But Herter is playing, you know, he's playing big minutes. He's playing 32 minutes a game, and the overall team is 18 points better per 100 when he's on the court versus off the court. And I just can't help people, you know, I just can't help think that people are not realizing what's happening with Red Velvet right now. He's just playing fantastic.
I do think that people fall in love with like the shooting numbers. Like you see the 7 3-pointers per game, the 50% 3-point shooting, and you're like, oh,
seven attempts.
What did I say?
Yeah, you said seven per game, and my and the only reason I cut you off is because I think he should be making 7 3-pointers per game. I think he could do this.
Yeah, I absolutely think he can too. But I think people just kind of say like, oh, he's like you said, like the Kyle Korver movement shooter type. But unlike Kyle Korver, like you said, he's got really good off the bounce chops. He can move the ball a little bit. He can drive with a little bit more moxie. And when you combine those skills, which is the bunch of the skills that the Kings have overall, like that's what makes him so deadly.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. And they're starting Harrison Barnes. So you get Fox, Herter, Sabonis. You get the interactions we've talked about. They're starting Harrison Barnes, which is kind of, I mean, he's like a modern current big forward to play the four these days. But it's also in this theme of being a little bit more offense than defense. I mean, Barnes gives them some defensive sturdiness, but he's not a defensive specialist. He's not a rim protector. He's not a kind of another traditional big man. And so Sabonis is not a great defender either. Sabonis is not particularly vertical or tall. And then he's got all this juice offensively that we talked about. So it is an offensively slanted lineup. But because of everything that you mentioned with Sabonis, because of Fox's straight line speed, the other thing that they do is they play with great pace. It's just fantastic. They will get down the court off of a miss in like, I mean, sorry, off of a make, excuse me. They'll get down into their set in like 3 seconds off a make. You look at the shot clock, it's at 21. They're already coming at you. Some of this is Fox's speed, but it's also coaching and purpose. And just going back to the podcast I did with Mike D'Antoni, talking about how one of the critical components of pace and space was the pace part, to realize that you're putting a time pressure under defenses to organize and set up quickly. And the Kings are really good at coming at that stuff early and attacking sort of those small advantages as teams recoup. And the other guy we have to shout out offensively here, because they'll start Keegan Murray, they'll start Terrence Davis, they'll throw other guys in there. But Malik Monk off the bench has been the fourth guy. And I said earlier there's three clear statistical stars. I misspoke, Cody. You should have corrected me and sent me right into podcasting jail, because Malik Monk offensively, 21 points per 75, 37% three, way more aggressive to my eye, going to the basket, quick decision making. He's physically stronger and sturdier. If you haven't seen him play in a couple years, he's been the fourth real kind of guy that jumps out to me on film. Is like, oh, this is another offensive piece that fits with Herter, fits with Sabonis, fits with having a spread pick and roll speedy point guard like De'Aaron Fox.
Well, I think the magic of having a DHO hub like Sabonis is it helps guys like Monk, who, you know, we've seen the last couple of years, he shows flashes, right? He's a great shooter. He can get some good straight line speed, but you don't necessarily want to give him the ball and be like, go run 20 pick and rolls, keep our offense afloat. He's not that kind of guy. But if you have someone that can get him some momentum first, right? If you have someone like Sabonis that can get him the ball while he's moving in a certain direction, I think that's where he starts thriving, right? Whereas like De'Aaron Fox, when Sabonis is off the court without Fox, right? I mean, sorry, when Sabonis is off the court and Fox is playing, right? They still have like a 118 offensive rating, still a very strong offensive rating. That's because Fox is a kind of guy that you can give the ball and be like, all right, your first step speed, your handling ability is good enough where you can kind of buoy the offense without a DHO hub. But Monk is the kind of guy, and I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I would venture a guess that the offenses are much better when he's out there with Sabonis than without, because that's the kind of guy that's going to be able to juice and kind of supercharge his own abilities.
You're saying Fox and Sabonis paired?
I'm saying Monk and Sabonis.
Monk and Sabonis, yeah. Monk and Sabonis. Well, we can get the stats department on that in a sec. But just one thing that's jumped out to me about Fox, which kind of connects to Sabonis, is his mid-range is just completely gone up to a totally different stratosphere this season. And you don't expect shooting jumps like that to be so stark, so there's probably some regression coming. But he's taking almost 10 mid-range jumpers every 75 possessions, which roughly translates to a full game. And he's making 54% from the mid-range this season, Cody. For Fox, that's along with the three-point shooting jump, he's at about 38% from downtown right now. That's one of the more prolific mid-range shooting displays in the league. To compare to some players, that's Jalen Brunson's, it's basically his literal numbers right now. Same number of attempts, 54%. Kevin Durant, 12 attempts instead of Fox's 9.5, 54%. DeMar DeRozan, 13 attempts, 50%. Joel Embiid, 11 attempts, 51%. So he's really incorporated this third level to his game effectively that goes so well with little Sabonis handoff actions or the kind of side-to-side things. That's another thing the Kings do really nicely, right? They'll change sides of the court deliberately to set up an attack, to try to move the defense one way just a little bit, swing it back the other way, and then attack a closeout or attack something that doesn't look like a huge advantage because the defense had shifted just a step or two because they were worried about like a De'Aaron Fox pick and roll or something. It's really a lot of lovely stuff.
That's I'm glad you brought up the both sides thing, Ben. This is just perfect. I don't remember who they were playing against these last couple of days. I want to say it's the Grizzlies. It might have been the Warriors, but I thought it was the Grizzlies. I think it was a lineup where Metu was in, right? And they don't always go to having him being a DHO guy like Sabonis, but in this particular play, he was at the top, holding the ball, ready for some DHO stuff. You have Fox in one corner, and it looks like he's going to come off a pin down before getting the handoff, right? But he rejects it. Okay, he rejects that, sprints baseline to go to the other side. So then Metu is like, all right, I'll do a handoff with somebody else. Well, now that you have the defense shifting, Fox comes off a double stagger on the opposite side, catches the pretty basic pass from Metu, and all of a sudden, like with Fox's blinding speed, he's getting downhill for a layup. And so when you have just this one player that's open to being like, oh, I'm not going to get it right now. I'm actually going to sprint over here so I can throw the defense off a little bit more. That's what opens it all up. And I think Fox, you know, you can kind of see it in his load numbers. Like we were talking about Trey and Luka being in the like plus, you know, 60-something loads. De'Aaron Fox's offensive load is like, what, 48? At the moment, like he's not a super high offensive load guy, and he's really buying into being more of an off-ball threat. And you can see that with his catch and shoot three numbers. You can see it on the film when you see him, you know, changing sides and moving around a lot more.
Well, that's a component I love this year that they've added. I'm so happy you mentioned that, because for a player like Fox, in the past, you know, the question is, well, he's a roadrunner, he's a speedster, but if you can't shoot that well, what's the off-ball contribution? How do you blend with other talent? And that play you highlighted is just a perfect example where he can get off the ball and then use his speed off the ball as part of the offense, because the offense isn't stagnant. The offense isn't just a bunch of spread pick and roll. So, you know, he can circle around in that instance, and then catching it in the handoff action, he already has used his speed to gain a little bit of an edge over a defender. Burst downhill, you add that with the transition, and when you combine that with what he's doing in the mid-range and then his speed in transition, I mean, he's not someone who puts relentless pressure on the rim despite how quick he is. He's not someone like John Morant, right? But when he gets there, he's very effective. And I feel like outside of Sabonis, that's the whole Kings team. Like, they don't have a lot of guys that can create tremendous rim pressure, but Fox is shooting 83% at the rim. Sabonis is shooting 78% at the rim. Harrison Barnes is shooting 78% at the rim. You create space, use the shooting and the movement, and you play with pace, and you get, you know, higher percentage shots for these guys to finish.
A guard shooting 80% from the rim is
83%. Yeah,
it's absurd, but it makes sense, because what really works, and this goes back to using Sabonis to kind of take away the fact that he's not a traditional floor spacer, is, you know, even though teams aren't afraid of him shooting threes, you still have to defend him. Like, the big still has to be up there, because if Herter comes off a handoff, all of a sudden he's wide open and he's going to bury it. So the big has to be up there to defend it. And if all of a sudden, like, last second you reverse it to Fox, there's no big in the paint for him to defend down there. So, like, that interaction between these three guys, especially that we've been talking about, just opens up the lane so that Fox doesn't necessarily have to be like Ja, who's just like, well, there's three bigs in there, I might as well go over or through all of them. Fox has a little bit more of a clear lane that he's able to beat everyone to, because he's, I don't know, one of the quickest, maybe the quickest first step in the league at the moment.
All right, if Cody, just to put this in perspective, because after I said it out loud, I realized, you know, this is ridiculous. If you look at players who have taken only just a couple rim attempts per game in the entire league, Fox is 83%, is third in the entire league. Terrence Mann from the Clippers, DeAndre Ayton is at 83%, and then De'Aaron Fox. That's it. And usually, it's, you said, it's a bunch of big men. Bol Bol, DeAndre Jordan, Evan Mobley. These are the other kind of names that are up at the top of the list. Sabonis himself is in the top 20 at 78%. So, yeah, I believe in this offense. I think this is a really good offense. I think even with regression, you know, as long as there aren't major injuries, as the season goes on, I think there's still going to be a really successful offense. It's a fascinating story thinking about, you know, Mike Brown's background and some of the other coaches in there as well. In addition to Brown, they brought in Jay Triano as sort of an offensive czar from Charlotte. So I guess if anything with the Kings, and this might segue us into another conversation, because I know you've had very strong thoughts on this lately, it's more the defensive side of the ball. How much can they hold up defensively if they get in a playoff series? You know, what does it actually mean? And when we talk about a guard like Fox, who has certain physical tools on ball as a defender that some of these other players don't, where does Fox fall in this crazy kind of like era we're in, where apparently you get in the playoffs and guards can like cost you like 5 points a game from their defense? Just something crazy. It's like if you have a weak guard on defense, you know, the Celtics felt this a couple years ago, first with Isaiah Thomas, and then they came back with another small guard in Kemba Walker. And, you know, back when Kemba was younger and healthier, he had a really good year, his first year with the Celtics. And then you get to the playoffs and they're like, we would like you, and pick and roll every time. You know, how do these offensive only teams with guards like this, how do they hold up?
This is huge, Ben. This conversation right here is fascinating, because the spectrum of defensive talent among guards in the league right now, you know, you've watched your fair share of historical ball. Does it feel like it's the widest spectrum that we've basically ever seen between the worst defensive guards to the best? Because like you have some guys like Trae Young, just an utter disaster on defense. John Morant is pretty lost. Like, you watch the Grizzlies and Tyus Jones subs in, all of a sudden they're like, man, when did they get Dennis Johnson like on this team? Like, this is incredible. And I don't think Fox is there. Right. I think Fox is, you know, I think he can get locked in once in a while and do some good defensive things. I don't think he's necessarily going to help your defense, but I wouldn't put him in that area. But then you have guys like Stephen Curry, who's like, you know, he fits in well with good defensive systems. He himself's a good defensive player. And then you have all the way up to like the Marcus Smarts of the world, who's just like, man, this guy's clearly adding something to your defense. That's a huge gap that I just don't remember seeing from watching all these historical games these last couple of years.
It's funny you mentioned Tyus Jones. He is dead last in defensive Raptor to start the season, and he's in the third percentile in defensive RPM. So
I'm going to jump in.
So
on that.
Yeah, go ahead,
Ben. I'm a stats guy. I love my numbers. That is wrong. That number is very incorrect.
Yeah. I was just going to say, at least statistically, relative to Morant to start the year, at least Tyus isn't quite in the Dennis Johnson group. But, you know, looking at this board, Malik Monk is currently in the first percentile in the league in defensive Raptor, in defensive RPM, and in defensive Raptor box score only component, which looks at tracking data and a ton of other things that are kind of interesting. And as many of you who are familiar with these all-in-one numbers, trying to take stuff like plus minus data, look at the changes when a player is on and off the court, incorporate tracking data and other information we have, we know these numbers aren't perfect. We know these numbers are noisy. We also know it's early in the season. But I mean, Malik Monk is first percentile in all these stats right now. How is that going to hold up in the playoffs? Fox has always been a question mark. He's 21st percentile and 43rd percentile. I actually think Herder is a pretty solid defender. Mm-hmm. I think he uses his size, uses his body, positions himself well. I think he's kind of sneakily solid on the ball, and then communicates and seems pretty aware of what's going on off the ball. They do start Keegan Murray sometimes, the rookie. He might be their sort of best perimeter defender piece, but I think it's just a larger question, and it's not even necessarily something we have to get hung up on the Kings with specifically, but how much does it hurt you if you kind of have a soft or really weak defensive backcourt when you get to the playoffs? And of course, like, doesn't Trae Young start this scale? Isn't that where we're at? Where all the studies that keep coming out keep saying, like, wow, as good as Trae Young is on offense, he's giving a lot of it back defensively.
One of those studies is called I Watch Atlanta Hawks Games. And that's probably the most damning one that I've seen when it comes to his defense.
Just turning the game on?
Yes. Immediately being like, oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, no. Like that. I feel like that's what happens when I watch him there.
That, you know what's funny is that the Hawks defense this year is actually slightly above average. They've been solid. And you know, they're is that just the ability to protect him? Is that just a regular season thing? I don't know, but I mocked them earlier in the year for sort of defensive shortcomings, but I think they've been able to hold up okay defensively. The weirder thing that happens is like when you get in situations against good teams, and this is what happens in the playoffs, and they start really, really attacking that weakness, how much does it hurt?
Here's the thing about the Hawks, though. Here's the thing. They're like 1 point better than league average on defense, right? That's a solid enough defense. But Clint Capela, right now leading the league in defensive RPM. You have DeJounte Murray, who's like in the top 10 in defensive RPM. DeAndre Hunter is a rangy, strong wing that can match up against other wings. John Collins, not necessarily a good defender, but I know in the past he's had some solid rim protecting chops. And, you know, I always like it when teams have multiple guys they can rotate down to rim protect. With those players, I would expect a better defensive rating, if we're being honest.
Okay. That I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Plus Okongwu,
yeah.
I think, is pretty solid as another defensive piece. Yeah, so they have defensive talent around him. And of course, you'd expect a better defensive rating because Trey is probably bleeding some of that value back on that end. But, I mean, you said it earlier. Is this the point in time where we have the greatest disparity between low-end, small guard defensive value in the playoffs and strong small guard defensive value in the playoffs? Like one end of the spectrum is Trey and the other end of the spectrum is Marcus Smart. And is that the difference between like a really weak rim protecting big man, or just a big man who's just like a major defensive problem in the postseason, and then like the defensive player of the year? That it feels like the gap is like almost that big at this point.
It does, and maybe this is probably a whole other episode, but that's part of the secret. I think when you see the Bucks playing, is like obviously they have Giannis and they have Brooke playing defense, but then Javon Carter and Drew Holiday, like there's just so much defensive intensity on the perimeter, so much flying around, so much being able to switch around, just being a pest, that I don't know. It's jarring when you turn and then you watch something like the Grizzlies or the Hawks, and you're like, wow, that's another blown coverage that gave up a layup. Wow, that's another blown coverage that gave up a wide open three. And you know, I do think that the actual impact at the end of the day is bigger than it's ever been.
So you think you know on the historical spectrum, because the reason why the historical part is so interesting to me is there was a period of time where you'd hear people say like, well, yeah, you can't win with Steve Nash because you can just go score 40 points a night on him. This is when the game was more kind of individualistic, more one-to-one pairings, less switching, less of these complex three-man actions or movement actions that we're seeing today. And so the idea was like, oh, if you're in the playoffs and you have a good offensive point guard or even a good wing, you can just constantly go at Nash in isolation. I'm using Nash as a big example, but there are other players. Tony Parker, you know, is another player who people have questioned his defensive chops at that point in time. Basically, any small, soft point guard that didn't look like they were a strong defender, and you go like, well, anybody can hang 30 points a night on them. And what really matters is how does the team efficiency change when you went after those players? And sure, those players may have been negative defenders, but to the point of this conversation, it's hard to find evidence. And even when you go back and watch the films, it's hard to see how those players were completely, completely fracturing their team's defense. You know, whereas today you'll turn on a game and you'll just be like, it feels like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 possessions in a quarter, a major breakdown is happening because they're going after or exposing the defense of one of these really small guards. And then the rest of the time, the defense is scrambling to figure out how to protect the small guard on the possessions that actually go well, making sacrifices in places and things like that. I actually think it's one of the big reasons why last season, and you mentioned this, Cody, I believe at the time, the Celtics going to point Marcus Smart where they've gone and never looked back, him going from the shooting guard and trying to help be part of the brigade that protects the weak point guard defensively to just becoming the point guard defensively. It's like, no, we don't have any weak defenders anymore. Now we're one of the best defenses, you know, of the decade or something like that. I think that move was symbolic of this kind of jump, this divide you're talking about between the best defensive point guards or small guards, if you will, Drew Holiday, Alex Caruso, these kinds of guys that you can put out there versus the sort of Trae Young, John Morant on one extreme end of the scale. But even like Dame Lillard, it's always been an interesting thing to me to juxtapose the people who talk about Dame Lillard and Steph Curry as being similar player. Oh, Curry might just move a little bit more. It's kind of the similar thing. Like, you watch them defensively, Curry is, especially last year, but even a couple years ago, was like on a different level up than Lillard. So how many levels are there to this thing? Is there like Trey and then Morant and then Lillard and then Curry and then another one and then like Smart and Holiday? If you can make five or six distinct jumps, that's a pretty huge value range for just that position defensively.
And something that you said that I really, really want to emphasize here is that, like, when you go back to the mid-2000s, the 90s, the 80s, when you talk about a bad defender, that's like the one-on-one, I'm pulling up my shorts, I'm slapping the court, you're going to score on me. But at the end of the day, like, there's still an NBA player with NBA player-level athleticism. Like, you still either, like, if you're going to get an efficient shot, you have to blow by them, which is probably tougher than you might think in that situation, or you're going to have to take a contested shot. And even though maybe you're 6'3 with a short arm span, that's still a contested shot. That's not particularly an easy shot. But now, like, you don't, like, you go back to these previous generations, you don't see the level of movement that we're seeing on offense right now that we've been talking about with the Kings. And instead of being like, oh, they got the switch on Trey or something like that, it's like, nope, this person blew a coverage, which opened up either a wide open three or a layup. And all of a sudden the points per possession on that endeavor just becomes huge. Like, it's not like, oh, that person's a bad defender, so their defensive field goal percentage against is this. It's like, nope, right, because of their missed rotation, this team got a wide open three-point attempt from Kevin Huerter.
Right. It's like if you're the Suns and you're in the playoffs and you're playing the Lakers, and it's and you can get Kobe to have Nash switched onto him at the elbow, what you're doing is you're upgrading a 46% elbow turnaround jumper to a 53% elbow turnaround jumper because you have less, contesting of the shot because the player's shorter, he's not as strong, things like that. That's very different than, and you laid it out perfectly. Like, if you have a breakdown, if you have a switching miscommunication, if you completely botch what's happening at the level of the screen, take Anthony Edwards and the Timberwolves. We're going to have a Timberwolves defense video come out. One of the points in that video is there's a game, and sometimes it happens too often for my liking, there's a game where he keeps getting rejected at the point of the screen. And the problem is there are certain coverages you can't have that happen in. Just ever. And one of those coverages is what Minnesota likes to do with Karl Anthony Towns coming up to the screen. So that is a breakdown defensively that is one of the most valuable sort of opportunities for the offense to have. And it's totally different in terms of value change than having a guy who's small guarding the post 20 years ago, or a weak isolation defender versus strong isolation defender 20 feet from the basket with poor spacing 15, 20, 30 years ago. It's a totally different thing. In addition to that, I think what happens with some of these guys we're talking about, they're too small to usually scramble back and recover into the play in any meaningful way. So if you're bigger, you can get back, you can get the defensive rebound, you can block a shot, you can box another big guy out, you can come back into the play after an error, and still do something, right? But when you're small, it's like you make this catastrophic breakdown at the team level, and then the best case scenario is you make like a great switch to cover up for someone else's mistake, and you use your speed and like get a steal as the defense is in rotation. And frankly, these guys usually don't do that. That's why they're such leaky defenders.
Yeah, and you know, you can turn on a Hawks game and you can see Trey giving this kind of effort, right? You can see him trying to recover to a guy. Like, he does try. It's not like he's out there just like hands on his knees not trying. But when he like sprints out to somebody in the corner and leaps for a contest, I mean, he might as well not be there sometimes. So if you're out of position even for like a second or a foot and a half out of position, you know, he's not going to be able to recover in time. Whereas like there's that famous play from the offseason where you had Giannis playing an international play and he like started on the other side of the rim and recovered to block the three-point shot. Like, you physically can't see Trae Young doing that kind of thing. So, you know, before we get out of here, Ben, I've been sitting on this statistical little factoid that I need to share with you, because
a statistical little factoid?
Yes, I think we need today because
ready.
It's busting some notions that people are having about a player right now.
Wait, we're done? What did we even talk about today? I feel like we started by looking at some standings, and then we were like, oh, the Kings are amazing, and now we're talking about the historical range of defensive point guard value. What are we done with the show? Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, we started with Rush's album, The Offensive Kings, and then went to everything else. But we're ending with this. This is what the people want. Like I said, they always want us to end reading stats.
Okay, I just want to say there's a sentence that you said a minute ago about like comparing the old days to the new days with all the motion and movement and really successful, beautiful offense like the Kings. And the odds of that sentence being spoken at any point in the last 15 years have to be almost zero.
Yeah, I was going to say there's like the last time they made the playoffs, maybe you could say it, but no, there are not many times, Ben.
Okay, statistical factoids. I'm ready. Let's do it.
Right now, Ben. There's one player in the league that is averaging 25 points per 75 on plus 13 efficiency. This is part one of my factoid. Do you know which player this is?
I assume I'm not allowed to look this up, right?
No, I'm gonna test you here.
Okay, so here's the thing. I know Jokic is really close to those numbers, but I don't know if he actually hits it.
It's Jokic.
Yeah, okay.
So Jokic is averaging 25.3 points per 75 on plus 13.2 relative true shooting percentage. Ben, do you know how many players in history, era-adjusted points per 75, have averaged 25 points per 75 on plus 13 efficiency ever?
Okay, so part two of this, I know that Curry led the league in scoring and efficiency in 2016, but he wasn't at plus 13. He was at like plus 11 or 12 or something like that. So we might just be missing the cutoff. And then I know there's some crazy efficient seasons from people like Artis Gilmore, but he doesn't have the volume to get up to 25. So Cody, I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to slam the table. That might have been the worst sound ever since it shook my mic. I'm slamming the table here, Cody. I'm going to say zero players in NBA history have ever done this.
Ben, you win the prize. No one in history has ever averaged 25 on plus 13. Now, caveat, Curry in 2016, like you said, 33 on plus 12.8, right? So he didn't quite hit it, but he's right there. And then Charles Barkley in 88 had a 27 plus 12.7. So those are the only two guys that were there, right?
And I think those are adjusted. I think Curry's raw was a little lower. Mm. And that scoring rate you're citing is adjusted for inflation. And that makes this statistical factoid even more interesting, because the offenses are so good right now that when you adjust Jokic for inflation, he would actually go down a little bit. He would go down to like 24 or something off the top of my head.
Okay, so you're saying that Jokic, this whole thing is just proving that Jokic is as much of a fraud as people are saying.
Oh, he's a total fraud. Yeah, just 25 points per 75 possessions, and you know, almost 70% true shooting, and you know, having a 125 offensive rating when you're on the court for your team, which is the third best in the entire league. You know, the Nuggets. I have a factoid to counter with you, because I was listening. I'm not gonna mention it. It was an interesting show. I was listening to a discussion about an award on the Low Post this week, and I'm not going to mention that award because I don't think it should be talked about for at least two more months. But they were talking about candidates for this award, and I looked something up with Jokic because he wasn't in the top five. Jokic, the Nuggets, Cody, are plus 13 points per 100 when he's on the court. And they're minus 15 points per 100 when he's off the court. So they're one of the best teams in the league when he's on the floor. They're the best offense, basically, in the league when he's on the floor. And they completely fall apart. He has what would be the all-time change in net on-off. It's very likely that that regresses down as the season goes on. But I don't know what more you can do as an offensive machine. And I think what's happening, Cody, is some people are criticizing Jokic for not shooting enough. And it's like he's so good at basketball at this point. I think this is the best offense he's ever played. I think we're watching someone right now, every night, who is a candidate to be the best offensive player anyone has ever seen in the history of the sport. And what's happening is his decision-making and passing are so good that people are checking the box score after the game, and they're like, why didn't he score more himself, right? And there's been some games where he has been a little bit more passive than he has been in the past, and there's some games where he hasn't shot as much, and that's yielded criticism. I only think one of those games they actually lost, and he was in a lot of foul trouble constantly throughout the night. The other times that's happened, he's just picked teams apart with passing, and it's like, if you play the first half and you're 4-for-4 from the field with like 13 assists and your team is up by 30 points at halftime, and you watch the game and you break down the clips and you're like, oh no, he just makes the perfect decision on every play. And as a sidebar, he doesn't miss his own shots. I don't understand why anyone is thinking that this isn't still an all-time great. Like, I just don't get the criticism of, oh, his scoring rate's down a little, because yeah, he's got more weapons than he had last year. So passing to them or the decision-making calculus changes. And in addition to that, like, there's a thing where he's also trying to probably bring Jamal Murray and Michael Porter up to speed and get confidence and get rhythm. And it's not a big deal if you don't try to take over every game with scoring. That's my rant. That's it.
And I think another thing that goes into it is I think he's been passing up more threes more than any other kind of shot. And here's the thing that's fascinating, right? His efficiency has spiked like we've never seen. His rookie year, his average shot distance was 7.5 feet, right? Between 2017 or 2018 and last season, he was past 10 feet for average shot distance, okay? Past 10 feet. So his average shot was at least 10 feet away from the basket. This season, it's about 6.5 feet. He's completely moved his offensive game towards the basket, closer to the basket. And he's just like, you know what? I'm just going to stop like shooting too much out here because I'm unstoppable when I get in the paint. I force everyone to double team me. And then I'm just like, I don't know, one of the best passers of all time. And I'm just going to pick you apart this way.
Cody, I'm looking at our database we share with our subscribers, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. We talked about De'Aaron Fox and his cute little 54% mid-range field goal percentage this year. Do you know what Nikola Jokic is shooting from the mid-range? 7 shots per 75. You know what his field goal percentage is from the mid-range?
You should say it, because I'm looking at it right now.
It's a 59%. 59%. And then he's so weak at the rim. What's he shooting at the rim?
80% at the rim.
This is ridiculous. If you want to support this show, head on over to patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. We do have daily boards for players and teams that update regularly that have a ton of the stats that you hear us cite throughout these episodes and in videos. They're the stats I look at regularly. We also have a Discord community. We have extra content. We've got a bunch of little quick-hitting videos that we've thrown up at the start of the year. Patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. That's the best way to directly support this show. Hope everyone out there had a safe and healthy and fantastic and drama-free Thanksgiving, that you are enjoying the basketball, and of course, wherever you are listening from, that you are having a great day.